go-getter, you know, achiever kind of person. And so what does it mean for me that I have a disability, and what does it mean for my son? You know, at that point, you have no idea. You know, obviously, we don't know our paths. The Lord does, but we don't know them from the beginning. But that was much more apparent to me at that point because of his disability, right? We think we're in control of life, and that was just one of those reminders. You are not in control, but the Lord is. But that was all a process. So my background in OT, our family situation, and then I was nursery coordinator at my church, and there were three young kids born with significant disabilities all in the same year. Mm-hmm. And you know, it was just very natural for me to want to make a place for them, to want to care for the families. You know, these kids aged out of normal nursery activities, but they were not cognitively or behaviorally able to just progress with their peers. You know, and again, there was this, the threesome. So it's like, okay, we need to do something for them. So we, with a group of others, we, you know, developed some special classrooms for them. But, you know, the priority was we want families to be able to come to church and worship. And we want to be able to reach these kids at their developmental level. You know, they couldn't handle the larger, busier classrooms of the fours and fives. You know, so they needed something different to really help them be a part of the church and worship, and their families to worship, and them to receive teaching at their level. So about the time that that was starting, MNA, Special Needs Ministries, began. So Stephanie Hubach was the founder of that ministry, and she's written this excellent book, Same Lake, Different Boat, which was a real godsend for me. It outlines a biblical view of disability that I'll talk about in a few minutes. So that was helpful for me personally, but also in responding to the needs of those in our church. So I first of all, received support from this ministry in the local church context, and then became more and more involved as a volunteer, ministering to others, you know, being a consultant for different churches. And then was able to come on staff. We've gone through, again, the name change, some staff changes, that sort of thing. So, yes, we are now engaging disability with the gospel. And we're, you know, our passion is to enfold families affected by disability within the church and really support them as they seek to train and teach and just live a life, you know, with disability in their midst. And my family is now at a different church, a little closer to our home, and I've been, you know, it's been encouraging to see the Lord's movement there. You know, big picture, God is in control of so many details, and multiple pastors at that church have had family members with disability, and our being there was kind of like, okay, we need to think about this. It was just like one more piece that God laid before them to say we need to be intentional about reaching out to and seeking to meet the needs of those affected by disability. So again, I mentioned the disability ministry, and our mission as a ministry is to engage people touched by disability with the gospel for their salvation and spiritual growth, and to equip churches to enfold them into all areas of congregational life and ministry. We are a ministry of the PCA, but we also, you know, definitely want to reach out to our like-minded, you know, other congregations, and so we're happy as we're able to minister, you know, definitely across those borders. Also, you know, can point folks to a lot of resources. So if we don't have exactly what you need, then we can send you in a direction. I have some brochures about the ministry downstairs, and I also have local, if you'd like to sign up to receive our newsletters. We do quarterlies, which often include a special disability area focus with some training or resources for that. And you could check out our website. There's a lot of resources there as well. Okay. And again, Stephanie Hubach started the ministry. She wrote this book. She has a son with Down syndrome. And that was, it's an amazing book. I strongly encourage you to check it out if you have interest or ability. There's also, she did a teaching series, which is available on our ministry YouTube channel or Vimeo channel. So if you have time to have something on in the background, she's a very entertaining speaker, and there's great, great truths in here that I'm sure you would enjoy hearing. Okay, so why disability ministry? Psalm 139 was a great comfort to me as I processed my own disability and my son's. You know, two verses that we know well here. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. And, you know, my disability came actually from a car accident. I had a concussion. I was like in junior high and was in a car accident and had a concussion. And that scarring in my brain was where my seizures were starting from. And then my son, you know, who knows what caused his mix of needs. And I struggled with that, you know, because the doctor even said, oh, maybe that seizure, you know, happened and there was something it might have coordinated with, a particular eye thing that was probably developing right at that time. And as a parent, you know, it's very challenging to wrestle with that guilt, you know, and that sense of why did this happen? What in my life might have caused this, you know? So it was very helpful for me to take a step back and really come to firmly grasp and hold on to God's sovereignty, you know, and fearfully and wonderfully made, even though my brain injury didn't happen in my mother's womb, right? It came later. Just really embracing God's sovereignty in all those details of my life and my son's life and knowing his good purpose, you know, even in the midst of a very difficult situation. And this is also, we'll talk a little bit about this, but, you know, it gives an amazing opportunity to be people of light in the world, right, as this world devalues those who maybe aren't high achievers or don't kind of meet the social standard, right? We as Christians know that each one is fearfully and wonderfully made, and we have a great opportunity to be light in this regard. And then why disability ministry? We'll talk some more about some of the Body of Christ passages, but for the body does not consist of one member, but of many. The parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable. But God so composed the body, giving greater honor to the part that lacked it, that the members may have the same care for one another. So again, I first became involved in disability ministry through my local church and really wanting to enfold those families that some were friends of mine or just, you know, were right there in my midst, and then had a growing participation in that. You know, it is challenging. Again, we need renewing of our minds, and that's one reason I picked that Romans 12 chapter in those verses, because we are so influenced by the world, you know, and the parts of the body that seem to be weaker are indispensable, you know, and God has gifted us with all those parts. Also, as a disability ministry, you know, we're not about disability rights, you know, and often it's challenging because families have to do a lot of advocating for their children's needs, or if you've had another loved one in the hospital for something or needing rehab services, sometimes you really have to go after the system, right, to get them what they need. And we really want to help folks see that it's for the good of the body. You know, we're not a disability rights, you know, we need this in the church. You know, the church does need those folks with disabilities, and we do want to show care for them. But, you know, don't be concerned. I'm not saying, you know, you have to do everything, and that the church is definitely different than the world systems, educational system, that sort of thing. So there has to be grace in our relationships with one another. While we try to do everything we can, sometimes, you know, it's very challenging to meet the needs. So we'll talk about some of those. Okay. This is, I know you probably can't see it at all, but I'll just give you some key points. This is from Johnny and Friends, 2014, and they're showing some research here about barriers to inclusion in the church. This is from a 2010 study, and what you see there are the different barriers. So people have responded, and the top barrier was the attitudes of folks in the church. So that's the top one. So 40% of whoever was surveyed said that the attitudes within the church were a barrier. The lack of accessibility is second, and that's 25%. You know, goes on to training, understanding, acceptance, friendships, transportation, some of those things further down. But the biggest thing was the attitude. This author writes, instead of turning to a handy list of do's and don'ts, congregations must dare to engage persons with disabilities. And another person writes, over the years of urging churches to include people with disabilities, I've come to believe that it is not the mechanics or the process that make it happen. It is the attitudes of the people that make it happen. So, you know, how do we respond when we see someone who's different? You know, hopefully we'll have a godly vision of other people, even who are so different from us, and be open to that. Not that we have to have all the answers, like I said, but that attitude of openness. So for this first section, we're going to just think about the first two verses of Romans 12. I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. And we do need that mind renewal. So as we come to this passage, we think about the foundations, you know, laid in chapters 1 through 11 of Romans, right? Such rich teaching. You know, the doctrine, what is true, who God is, the salvation that he has accomplished. And here he sums up all these great truths with the phrase, the mercies of God. I urge you, by the mercies of God. So then we move into therefore, how should we live? But we want to just pause and, again, think about disability. How do we think about disability, and how do we, you know, have renewed minds in thinking about disability? I have a quote from John Piper who says, God's mercy towards us is the way to live a lifestyle of mercy. From him, through him, to him. From him we get mercy. Through him we live in mercy. And to him we glorify God for his mercy. So again, this is all rooted in the gospel and in salvation. You know, if I asked you, how do you think about disability? There's plenty of verses that would probably come to your mind. I mentioned Psalm 139. Exodus 4, the Lord said to Moses, who has made man's mouth? Who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? And then you think about John 9, right, with the man born blind. As he passed by, Jesus saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, it was not that this man sinned nor his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. So we would be able to quote that, you know, or think of those off the top of our head, but there, we have a lot of influence from the culture around us. You know, it's helpful to think about these. The ADA definition seems like a funny place to go, but it helps us think about it. So the ADA definition of disability says that with respect to an individual, the term disability means a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more of the major life activities of such an individual, can be a record of such an impairment, or being regarded as having such an impairment. So there are two aspects. One is the functional, right, a part of the body that's not working as it was designed to work. And then there's also the social part, where being perceived as having a disability. So those are two different aspects that that we can draw out here, and we'll come back to that. So the modernistic perspective is the basis for the medical model of disability, and that focuses on what's broken, right? There's a part of the body that's not working as it's supposed to, and we need to fix it, right? That's the focus of the world. Fixing, eliminating the difficulty, or perfecting, right? Perfecting the body. We see that in extreme ways these days. But it's all, you know, to fix what's not working right. This is rooted in the Enlightenment, you know, thinking that, oh, we're moving towards utopia. We're going to work for a perfect society. We can work for perfect bodies. And while medicine is wonderful, you know, procedures, actual medicine, whatever it might be, is wonderful. It can't fix what's broken with our bodies, right? We know, so modernism would say that disability is an abnormal part of life in the world, right? There's something wrong with that person or that part of the body, and we're going to fix it, okay? So that's one of the things to think about as we go. And some of the influences of modernism, again, the medical model saying there's something wrong, we want to take care of that. Fixing the impairment. And we've been helped by medicine, but also that can be the source of abuses. You think about, you know, in our past, institutionalization, sterilization or elimination of people with disabilities. We don't often think about that. Probably for some of you growing up, you didn't grow up with people with disabilities in your school or in your church because they were elsewhere. They were put in an institution, something like that, so really moved. And while that has changed, the heart of it is still here in many ways. There's an article that brings out this title about nudgenics. So there, you know, you think about eugenics, perfect genes, wanting to get rid of those people with disabilities so that we have a pure race kind of thing. And that was done in some ways. Now, there's an article from actually a CBS News report from last October reported, and you may have heard this, that nearly 100% of women who in Iceland who had a diagnosis of Down syndrome, prenatal diagnosis, eliminated those babies, right? Because they did not want children with Down syndrome. And so this article brings out the nudgenics, right? We're not saying you have to get rid of these babies, you know, but we're encouraging you. So I'm going to read a little bit from that article. I think it's very powerful. The authors say, instead of using their coercive power in pursuit of this perverse idea, they, the Icelandic government, ensures that healthcare professionals nudge, persuade, or even pressure parents towards that end. Doctors can paint the most dire picture of the life of their disabled child without offering resources or any evidence that their child might actually live a fulfilling life, and that expertise carries a lot of weight. The person, one of the people who counsels women in these hospitals, when they have who have a pregnancy with a chromosomal abnormality, she tells the women who are wrestling with decisions or feelings of guilt about that. She says, "This is your life. You have the right to choose how your life will look. As long as the state isn't forcing anybody to do anything, there's really nothing wrong with a 100% termination rate of Down syndrome," they say. That's not eugenics or genocide. There's no targeting of a special official group. It's just individuals who happen to be making the same choice. That's scary. And that they summarize, the developing world is experiencing nudgenics, eugenics via nudge, and beyond that, overt pressure from doctors and other individuals. But victims are victims regardless of whether the act was a product of coercion, persuasion, or merely choice architecture, as these advertising folks talk about the nudge, you know, the nudge in advertising today about how they set things up to influence people to make a choice. And so, you know, we see, again, not the outright institutionalization or whatever, but we see the influence that society brings for families who are facing these difficult choices. So this all comes back to disability being an abnormal part of life in this world, you know, that they want to fix. Another way, kind of a reaction to modernism, is postmodernism. And this focuses more on, remember how the medical model would focus on what's broken, what's wrong, the functional aspect. This focuses more on the social or the relational aspect of disability, and it re-describes what's going on. Postmodernism tosses out truth, right? Everybody has a different view, and that's okay. What's okay for you is okay for you, but I think something different. You may, you know, have family members or friends who are not believers who are really influenced or hear that in the world around you. They say that, you know, there's no meaning outside of us. There's no God, no truth. So whatever works for you is fine. You know, you make your choice, I'll make my choice. They also focus on social issues and use language. So it's about rights or we're this kind of people and, you know, a people group versus the more the commonality. And they talk about people with disabilities being disabled because of how others perceive them and because others refuse to make accommodations, right? So it's like, if you made this accommodation, then I would be able to go. So they're not disabled because there's an impairment of the body. They're disabled because there's not a ramp or whatever, you know. So it focuses much more on the social aspect. Steph Hubach, again, who wrote this book and has a son with Down syndrome, early in his life, she was real active in some different like Down syndrome support groups. And she talked about a speaker at a Down syndrome conference who, this is a quote, having a disability is a difference like any other human characteristic. It's not a deficiency. It's by no means a tragedy and does not deserve pity or benevolence or charity. Now is the time to recognize and celebrate disability rather than ignore, devalue, or use it as a justification for lower expectations. So in some ways, right, there's some truth to that, right, that we do want to value the person. We don't want to just expect less because there's something going on. But it is celebrating the diagnosis. And it's not acknowledging that there are real difficulties that do come with Down syndrome or autism or whatever. So it kind of almost glorifies that. So postmodern view would say that disability is a normal part of life in a normal world, right? This person has Down syndrome, I have whatever, we're just different. It kind of takes away that imperative to be involved in one another's lives, just kind of separate people in separate, different situations. This book, Neurotribes, is a huge book, a lot on autism, the legacy of autism, and the future of neurodiversity. And I'm going to read some quotes. These are primarily quotes from Amazon reviews, but it gives a good picture into the response of the content. So I'm going to read some of the reviews. I was diagnosed with Asperger's last year at the age of 53. Finally, after all of these years, I continue to understand that I am not broken or in need of repair, just simply different. Right? So that's definitely the postmodern, right? I'm not broken. I'm just different, right? And you hear a lot of that in our culture. The author shows that autism is not a modern phenomenon. It's not a disease or even a deficit, but it's a result of differences in the wiring or neurodiversity. There's another buzzword, right? Neurodiversity of human brains that has appeared in human cultures throughout history. The author writes, in the final analysis, the focus on autism has led to the emergency of the concept of neurodiversity, the notion that conditions like autism, dyslexia, ADHD should be regarded as naturally occurring cognitive variations with distinctive strengths that have contributed to the evolution of technology and culture rather than mere checklists of deficits and dysfunctions. Again, so they're saying look at the whole person, the strengths as well as the difficulties. This is altogether a far more humane and satisfying viewpoint than the misconception that have held sway for most of human history. I'm going to read a few more reviews of this. Here are a couple that bring out the difficulties of the postmodernistic view. Someone says it's the worst book ever. It glorifies autism as if it's some utopian disorder we should all wish to have. Really. Be a parent of a child with autism. It is hard. It's nothing but worry for your parent. I absolutely hate the fact that it only focuses on how autism is so good for the tech industry. Another one says, this book draws the audience in with the positive movement of neurodiversity, but it's a whitewashing of autism, looking at all the positive aspects and none of the negative ones. There are no mentions of the meltdowns, self-injurious behaviors like headbanging or higher risk of suicide or shorter lifespan. The book suffers from a culture-wide distortion. Our culture has consistently overvalued and researched cognition without appreciating its interconnection to the affective, sensory, or motor functions. Individuals with autism spectrum disorders have much to contribute to our families and cultures, and they, whatever their level of functioning, deserve our understanding and support with respect to those areas that are challenging to them. It's counterproductive to focus on mainly the cognitive skills instead of the key characteristics that unite every individual with autism spectrum disorders, impairments in social emotional reciprocity, so more the relational part, nonverbal communication, impairments in developing and maintaining and understanding relationships. Our service delivery systems in both healthcare and education are woefully inadequate to help our family members with ASD address these challenges. So again, saying it's not right just to say this is great and it's helping the world, right? There are real difficulties. And then a couple more, two more quotes, and you're going to hear some of that historical view, the more the medical model coming out in these reviews. I don't say I have autism because to do so makes me feel like I have a disease. Oh, wait, that's what I always hear autism experts say. It's hard to pick up a publication like Scientific American or Discover Magazine and not find at least one article on the progress being made in the scientific community to eradicate the world of this insidious disease. The best part is they don't even realize they're insulting people. Oh, wait, I keep forgetting I'm not a human being. I'm a person. I'm a disease. Right? And so you see the difficulty there. Another one, I think Asperger, who the name Asperger syndrome comes from, said, our therapeutic goal must be to teach the person how to bear their difficulties, not to eliminate them for him, but to train the person to cope with special challenges with special strategies, to make the person aware not that they are ill, but they're responsible for their lives. So that was the person who first identified autism, and his theories, someone wrote, based on logic and experience, were tragically ignored and forgotten. Casualties of presumed association with Hitler, Nazism, and the policies of eugenics. Right. So you can hear those different voices on disability, you know, from our world. A few more. This is actually Kirsten Reichen, Phil and Lisa Reichen's daughter, if you know of them. And this is from a blog that she has written. And listen again for the influence of modern. She says, this is me. From the outside, I look like your average, healthy, strong, 20-year-old woman. I look normal. I'm just beginning my senior year of college. On any given day, you'll see me going to class, studying, going to the gym to work out, and having fun with my friends. These days, there are moments when I am able to forget about the internal brokenness of my physical body. The daily reminders, the pills, the dietary restrictions, the little aches and pains of my chronic illness have become so routine that they no longer make me feel like I'm anything less than the healthy 21-year-old woman I appear to be. But every 6 weeks, I drive myself to the hospital early in the morning. I sit in an armchair for 4 hours while the drugs trickle into my veins. Sometimes it all goes smoothly and I walk out at noon and carry on with my day. But more often than not, something goes wrong. Last week, the nurse missed my vein, and the fluids began to fill up my arm. My arm swelled painfully while my blood pressure plummeted, and I laid back trying to breathe through my internal panic and increasing lightheadedness. During these treatments, I drift in and out of uncomfortable sleep while the nurses worry that my blood pressure is too low, and alarms on the IV pump go on and off. These days, I shuffle slowly out of the hospital to my car, and I think to myself, this isn't normal. I can't pretend to be normal today. Mm-hmm. And then Frances Schaeffer, I think, was influential in Steph Hubach in framing these thoughts. And he says, if one begins to consider the differences between Christianity and rationalistic philosophy's answers, one must begin by understanding that man and history are now abnormal, he says in the God Who Is There, right? So we can stay with kind of that medical perspective that disability does involve a brokenness, right? There's something that's not working as it was intended to, and often relentless difficulties come with it. Adaptations can be made, but you often can't fix a disability, right? That's something that you're going to live with. It occurs across all cultures, just a common occurrence in our world, with regularity. And it can be influenced by the negative responses of others, right? So often we see something that makes us think less, right, or have an adjusted expectation of a person, so that those attitudes can disable. But we know that we live in a God-centered universe, right? And that this world is not as God intended it to be, and we will not live here forever, and all things will be made right. So, you know, as Christians, we know the bigger picture, right? We know the full story. And so if you think about that creation, fall, redemption, and glorification, that's our hope, right? God is with us now, and all things will be made right. But for now, many of us are living with some sort of disability or know someone who is, and as a church, there's definitely a call and a place where we have to offer that hope, right, that we've heard from these voices in the world, they are missing. So we know that all the whole creation has been groaning. So a biblical perspective on disability tells us that we live in a God-centered universe, not a naturalistic one where things just happen. And that disability, like every form of brokenness, is a result of a fall. So the key to a biblical understanding of disability is that disability is a normal part of life in the abnormal world. Remember the first one was disability is an abnormal part of life in a normal world, right? This is our world and there's something wrong with those people. Or the second was that disability is a normal part of life in a normal world, right? It just happens and those people have their things and we have our things. Well, as Christians, we know that the world is abnormal and that disability is one of the forms of brokenness that we encounter because of the fall. So nothing, you know, now is as it was intended to be, not the bodies we live in or the attitudes that we possess. So disability is a more noticeable form of the brokenness common. And so Seth's book was really helpful for me because I, again, had much more of an achievement performance mindset. So what happens when I can't achieve or I have no idea what my son's life is going to look like, right? Where is his worth and value? Where is my worth and value, not knowing what's going on in my life or what will? So Seth's first chapter, the title is On Truth, the four missing words, which are in an abnormal world, right? So we have to understand the world is not as God intended it to be, and obviously our hope is not fully here. So, this nice chart here, the fall affects every dimension of who we are. This has mental, psychological, emotional, social, physical, and spiritual. And because of the fall, none of us have complete capacity. She's a graph person. So nobody's at 100% because of the fall, right? We all experience brokenness in every area of our lives. Because of God's grace, nobody's at zero. Nobody's completely broken in all those areas of our lives. So you can think about yourself. What are your strengths or your kids? You know, where are each one stronger or weaker? Disability is a more noticeable form of the brokenness we all experience, right? So some of us can just hide it better than others, right? And some people, that brokenness is right before you, and you know, they can't hide it. It's very clear. So everything is impacted by the fall, but not ruined by the fall. This allows us to recognize the giftedness of even people with disabilities, right? Like Steph talks about her son with Down syndrome, and people with Down syndrome are often so friendly and engaging and just sincere, right? So they have incredible strength in more of a relational capacity, but you know, cognitively there are going to be some real difficulties. So we need to be able to look at one another, and particularly those with disabilities, as a whole person, and be able to see the strengths and weakness, you know, the strengths as well as the weaknesses. And that can be hard in our culture, which often is so word-focused, and even our church cultures, right, where we value certain behaviors or levels of understanding. And the reality is that those things are affected by for some folks. So we need to be able to keep in mind. I think that's a very helpful chart. It has been for me, so I hope it is for you as well. And we know that Christ is coming to redeem us and our brokenness, and it will be wonderful to experience those new bodies and what is to come. Okay, so disability is a normal part of life in an abnormal world. Make sure that I'm, yeah. You know, when we think people with disabilities are broken, but I'm not, that's very arrogant. That's very, you know, it's really a misunderstanding, and we want to appreciate the gifts that others bring. We talk about disability, but, you know, if you think about chronic illness also has a lot of these same things. This chart, again, is based on that medical or that definition where there's a functional ability, there's an impairment in a functional ability, and there's also a social response. With disability, the impairment can be very substantial, right? Usually there's a part of the body that's not working. Our friend Tina is blind, right? So she does not have vision. Often physical disabilities, those are easier to see. And socially, those are often stigmatized, right? Because we think of those people as very different. We don't know how to approach that. With chronic illness or even mental illness, the functional impairment can be very varied, and often it's fluctuating. It's depending on treatment, right? So they can be very well managed, and so it's less disabling in life, right? If that's the way I was after. I had 7 years where I was on medicine, seizure-free, you know, just take my pills and I'm fine. And then, right, that was just a portion of time. Then it became much more disabling again. I actually had brain surgery 5 years ago. And they were able, because of how my seizures started, they were able to destroy that point where the concussion was. And, you know, I'm very thankful. That was able to take care of it, but you know we don't always have. But praise God for medical advances that can treat things like that, or medicines that can appropriately treat these difficulties that we do face. So chronic illness or mental illness, you know, can be very well managed and treated, and someone can function very well. But then something can set them off, or with often with mental illness that can. The effects can be different in different environments, so it's not a consistent difficulty, right? Or think of a person with autism who can do very well in their set routine, right? They have a pattern. I mean, you think about, most of us are like that, right? If we're kind of in our comfort zone, we can do well. But you take somebody out of that into a totally different situation, and it can be much more disabling. So with chronic illness, the effects are more varied. And the social responses are challenging with chronic illness, or especially mental health. You know, a lot of us really still do not understand mental health, and there have been a lot of influences on why people have these problems, or should you just be able to trust the Lord and that take care of it? Well, there's a physiological component, right? And those, so we have to be mindful and just understanding or consider how we respond to people who have these things that we don't understand, you know. So the varied responses, they can be ignored, invalidated, right? You often hear people who have a chronic illness or fatigue, you know, and oh, I'm tired too. It's like, well, no, that's not the same thing as someone who has a chronic fatigue syndrome or something like that. It's a totally different level. They can be invalidated. You know, even me with my son, oh, you'll get it, you know, it'll be okay, just go and it'll be okay. You know, not really understanding all the challenges, maybe in a new situation. Or stigmatized again. Well, that person's so different from me. You know, we can't deal with somebody with that problem, right? So we need to be careful about those things and remember that commonality. So I have a list, and I think this is on your handout, of some different resources. Again, Stephanie Hubach's book is great. The first section is that foundation, a biblical view of disability. It goes into what's happening with families, which we're going to talk about more tomorrow, and then later on I'll be talking more about ministry within the church, facilitation within the church. A couple other books that you might look at, and I have a ton of books downstairs that I brought that you might just enjoy looking at and getting some ideas of things to read. So, again, just ending with these verses, Romans 12, 1 and 2. Not wanting to be conformed to this world, even as we think about disability, those with disabilities, or ourselves, with the brokenness that we experience physically, and wanting to be able to grow and welcome folks into our church. I have a video that I'm going to put on in the background. Has anybody seen this, Team Voight? This is a son who's in a wheelchair. Extreme cerebral palsy experience. Watch this. I'm going to read. Well, I'm going to let you watch it for just a minute and get a picture of who he is, and then I'm going to tell you some of that. The father runs marathons, this, athlons. It's a picture of our brokenness, right? We are unable to live and move and have our being apart from the Lord and unable to come to Him. So, we can think about this on so many levels, but, we are broken just like this man is broken, and we are totally dependent on the Father for our salvation, and in Him we live and move and have our being. I will tell you a little bit more about them when the son was about to be born. The umbilical cord got wrapped around his neck, depriving him of oxygen. Initially, doctors told the new parents their son would be a vegetable with no higher brain function. But the parents didn't believe it. They saw signs of life and intelligence in their son. Sure enough, the doctors discovered they were wrong. Rick did have higher brain function. However, the lack of oxygen did deprive him of the ability to control his muscles, leaving him essentially a quadriplegic. It's been a story of exclusion ever since he was born, Dick told the author, or the reporter. When he was 8 months old, the doctor told us we should just put him away. He'd be a vegetable all his life, that sort of thing. Well, those doctors are not alive anymore, but I would like them to be able to see Rick now. The couple brought their son home, determined to raise him as normally as possible. Within 5 years, Rick had two younger brothers, and the Hoyts were convinced Rick was just as intelligent as his siblings. The father remembers the struggle to get the local school authorities to agree. Because he couldn't talk, they thought he wouldn't be able to understand, but that wasn't true. The dedicated parents taught Rick the alphabet. We always wanted Rick included in everything. That's why we wanted him to get him in public school. A group of Tufts University engineers came to the rescue once they had seen some clear empirical evidence of Rick's comprehension skills. They told him a joke, said his father. Rick just cracked up. They knew then that he could communicate. The engineers went on to build using $5,000 the family managed to raise in 1972, an interactive computer that would allow Rick to write out his thoughts using the slight head movements that he could manage that you saw in there. Rick came to call it My Communicator. A cursor would move across a screen filled with rows of letters, and when the cursor highlighted a letter that Rick wanted, he would click a switch with the side of his head. Talk about labor intensive. When the computer was originally brought home, Rick surprised his family with his first spoken words. They had expected perhaps, "Hi, Mom," or "Hi, Dad," but on the screen, Rick wrote, "Go Bruins," the Boston Bruins, Stanley Cup Finals, And his family realized he'd been following the hockey games along with everyone else. So we learned then that Rick loved sports. In 1975, he was finally admitted to a public school. 2 years later, he told his father he wanted to participate in a 5-mile benefit run for a local lacrosse player who had been paralyzed in an accident. Dick, the father, far from being a long-distance runner, agreed to push Rick in his wheelchair. They finished next to last, but they felt they had achieved a triumph. That night, Dick remembers, Rick told us he just didn't feel handicapped when we were competing. Rick's own accomplishments, quite apart from the duo's continuing athletic success, have included his moving on from high school to Boston University, where he graduated in 1993 with a degree in special education. That was followed a few weeks later by another entry into the Boston Marathon. As he finally pictured it, on the day of the marathon, from Hopkinton to Boston, people all over the course were wishing me luck, and they had signs which read, "Congratulations on your graduation." Rick now works at Boston College's computer laboratory, helping to develop a system codenamed Eagle Eye, through which mechanical aids, like a powered wheelchair, could be controlled by a paralyzed person's eye movement when linked up to a computer. And in response to one of the articles, someone wrote in, and again, it just shows what we've been talking about. Rick, as much as I'm impressed with your dad, I want you to know that we have a much more that you have had a much more tremendous impact on me today. As I reviewed your website and saw the laundry list of accomplishments, I found myself in awe of all of the physical things you two have done together. But I was also surprised by the academic goals you have accomplished. That is what made me really take note. I was surprised that you were a college graduate and surprised that you were working on the Eagle Eye Project. And I realized that I'm sad that I was surprised. The fact that I overlooked your obvious mental capabilities made me ashamed. After reading everything about acceptance, I still miss the point. After this cold realization sunk in, I recognized that as good as your story is, the real value is in making someone like me realize I didn't default to giving you a fair shake. Even after seeing what you had done with the races, I basically gave credit to your dad, and I didn't give you the benefit of the doubt to simply assume that you went to a college. When it comes to possibilities, Rick, your father made me believe, but you made me understand. So I thought that was so powerful. Again, we look and we see the brokenness, and we discount maybe the rest of the person and how God redeems our brokenness and uses us, you know, in spite of and often because of that. So today, later on, we're going to talk about including people with disabilities within the church and then a greater understanding of what's happening in families. So I'll pray and then give it back over to you. Heavenly Father, we thank you for this time together. We thank you for, Lord, just the truth and the certainty that we have, Lord, that each one of us is fearfully and wonderfully made, Lord, that you have created us exactly who we are, Lord, for purposes. And Lord, we ask for forgiveness for the ways that we judge others and we discount, Lord, your image in them, your presence in them, your desire to use them to bless us and to serve your purposes in our lives. We pray that as individuals and in our churches represented, Lord,